The future is on the line. Democracy hangs in the balance. The stakes couldn't be higher.
You're listening to The Stakes, KPFA's weekly deep dive into the races, issues, and power struggles shaping America's democracy. As the 2026 midterm elections unfold, we go beyond campaign headlines to examine the policies, court battles, voting rights disputes, and grassroots movements driving the national conversation. Stay tuned for The Stakes. You're listening to The Stakes on KPFA. I'm Teresa Wersbianska with Scott Baba. Today on the show, Maine Democrats got punched in the feelings this week as sexual assault allegations seem to have stopped Senate candidate Graham Plattner in his tracks. We'll chat with Maine Morning Star political reporter Isha Pendarkar, who has been keeping up with that story. Also, campaign finance, money, politics. We'll speak with Brendan Glavin from campaign finance watchdog group Open Secrets about the Supreme Court's decision last week to change how political parties can use campaign funds to coordinate with candidates and what that means moving towards November. And watch out, the communists are coming. At least that's what President Trump is saying as he attempts to hold on to power in the face of a progressive wave in the Democratic Party. Michael Tomasky from The New Republic will join us later in the hour to discuss the Republican Red Scare strategy they hope will influence voters. But first, around the country.
In many states across the nation, Democratic primaries have featured contests between progressive candidates endorsed by the Bernie Sanders wing of the party and establishment candidates. The Michigan Senate race may be the most high-profile such battle this year. Eileen Alfandary reports on this week's debate between the two Democratic contenders.
The Michigan Democratic primary is between progressive-backed former Detroit and Wayne County Health Director Abdul El Sayed and establishment-backed Michigan Congresswoman Haley Stevens, a third candidate who was trying to chart a middle ground, dropped out on Sunday. During their first one-on-one debate, Stevens came after El Sayed, in effect calling him a millionaire publicity hound.
I am not trying to sell a book or a podcast. I'm the only one on this stage who doesn't have a talent agent trying to pitch me for paid speeches. And unlike my opponent, I'm not running at the first mic or camera I see. We do not need a celebrity senator. We need a workhorse.
El Sayed is an epidemiologist who has written books, hosts a podcast, and has worked as a commentator for CNN. He favors Medicare for all and denounces oligarchs, big money in politics, and U.S. support for Israel. El Sayed jabbed back at Stevens, saying she's beholden to corporate PACs and APAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee.
In this race, you've probably seen ad after ad after ad. Not one of those ads was brought to you by the Congresswoman's campaign. All of them brought to you by corporate PACs and AIPAC, trying to buy a politician who's going to do their bidding instead of yours.
AIPAC-affiliated spending for Stevens' campaign is estimated to total $20 million so far. Stevens focused on her opposition to the Iran war and criticized Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. She charged Republicans are spending money to prop up El Sayed's campaign, so Republican nominee Mike Rogers can have an easier path toward victory in November. El Sayed pushed back, saying he poses a threat to politics as usual.
You know, if Congresswoman Stevens makes it, or Mike Rogers wins, either way, Israel will win. AIPAC is perfectly fine with either of my two opponents because they know that they will have a comfortable, reliable vote in the U.S. Senate.
Congresswoman Stevens has consistently voted for military funding for Israel. El Sayed is endorsed by Silicon Valley Congressman Ro Khanna and Maryland Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen. Also by Independent Senator Bernie Sanders, New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Rashida Tlaib, who plan to campaign with El Sayed next week. Sanders recently highlighted El Sayed's support for Medicare for All.
Abdul, I don't know if all of you know it, wrote a book called Medicare for All. He literally is a doctor. He understands better than most how broken the current healthcare system is.
The United Auto Workers Union has endorsed El Sayed, citing his support for Medicare for All, as well as his refusal to take money from corporate PACs and his platform to support union workers. Instead of Medicare for All, Stevens calls for expansion of the Affordable Care Act. She has the support of Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Michigan Senator Alyssa Slotkin, and former longtime Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow. Stabenow posted an endorsement video with a nod to the electability argument, saying Stevens is the one who can beat the Republican candidate, former Congressman Mike Rogers.
I know she can beat Mike Rogers in the general election. The stakes have never been higher. And Haley Stevens is the right person at the right time.
Michigan is critical to Democrats' hope to recapture the U.S. Senate. To succeed, they must retain the seat held by retiring Michigan Democratic Senator Gary Peters and flip four Senate seats currently held by Republicans. The question some Michigan Democrats are now weighing as they begin early voting is whether progressive Abdul El Sayed can ride the wave of anger against the establishment to victory in November, or whether the more moderate candidate Haley Stevens is a safer bet. Current polls show the two running neck and neck with about 18% of Democrats undecided. Election day is August 4th. I'm Eileen Alfandari for KPFA News.
Democratic Senate nominee Graham Plattner's meteoric political rise has come to a screeching halt this week as allegations of sexual assault sparked a mass exodus of support from his campaign. Plattner formally suspended his campaign Wednesday. He announced his suspension in an 11-minute video on social media.
Hey, everyone. It's Graham Plattner here. I think, as many of you know, over the past couple days, I have faced some very serious allegations, and I just want to make it clear, this is all false. The things that have been claimed did not happen. It's not real. It has placed an immense amount of weight on me as I think about what needs to happen now.
This has left many baffled Mainers wondering what to do about flipping that Senate seat belonging to longtime Senator Susan Collins, and wondering also if that idea even remains possible. The allegation, first reported by Politico, comes just weeks after Plattner defeated Maine Governor Janet Mills in the Democratic primary. Plattner has denied the allegation, calling it false, and saying the encounter was consensual. In a video posted Monday, he said he would take time to consider the future of his campaign while maintaining his innocence.
I wanted to directly address the troubling, serious, and false allegations against me. Any accusation of non-consensual behavior is categorically false. Over the last 10 months, I have been deeply humbled by the faith Mainers have put in me.
But within hours, Democratic leaders and supporters moved away from Plattner. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer called on Plattner to withdraw. The Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee announced it would not spend money on the race if he remained the nominee. Maine Democratic leaders, the Democratic National Committee, and a growing list of elected officials also said they would no longer support Plattner's campaign. These allegations have also fractured the online progressive coalition that helped move forward Plattner's campaign. Among those reversing course was the political commentator Hassan Piker, who had enthusiastically backed Plattner during the primary.
This is a serious accusation of the highest order, and it has all of the hallmarks of a verifiable accusation. Okay?
All this is coming at a critical time for Democrats. Maine had been viewed as one of the party's best opportunities to flip that Republican-held Senate seat this November by challenging Susan Collins. But with Plattner's campaign now essentially imploded, party leaders are wondering who are they going to replace him with before the state's nomination deadline. Joining us now to help us figure out what's going on in Maine is Maine Morningstar reporter Isha Pendarkar. Hi, Isha.
Hi, how are you?
So Maine Democrats seem to be scrambling right now. It's kind of chaos. As of this interview, Graham Plattner has not dropped out of the race. Many people are telling him that he's done. What's the latest on the ground from Maine?
Yes. So as you said, he has not dropped out yet. I think we're all waiting to see if or rather when he drops out. The writing seems to be on the wall for his campaign. We've spent the last 2.5 days speaking with dozens of Democratic leaders in the state, former candidates for different races that endorsed him and campaigned with him, as well as many independent voters, most of whom supported him through his previous scandals, but now seem to have lost their faith in Plattner. And dozens of prominent Democrats outside of Maine have also made statements rescinding their support, including Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who also came to Maine to campaign with him. And he's lost at least a couple of major funding sources, such as the Senate Majority PAC. So despite the dozens of calls on him to withdraw, Plattner has not made a formal announcement. We just heard from a source familiar with this campaign that his advisors have been urging him to drop out, and he seemed agreeable to that. And that was yesterday, but again, we haven't had an official statement. And if he does not drop out until Monday, July 13th, he will be on the ballot this November.
And of course, by the time of broadcast, things are moving fast and things could change. At the time that you're listening to this, he may have actually announced that he has dropped out. The Maine Democratic Party, though, they need to figure out what to do. And they're also now saying that Plattner's campaign is trying to, quote, put their thumb on the scale. And Plattner's team is saying, no, we're just trying to ensure grassroots supporters have a voice. What do you think is going on with that scenario?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly some tension between those two right now. And the Maine Democratic Party was one of the first entities to call for Plattner to drop out of the race on Monday evening following the allegations of sexual assault against him. And then yesterday, the state Democratic Party sent out an email to their members saying that his campaign is trying to influence the selection process for his replacement. They also mentioned that they will not make the selection process public until he formally drops out. And Plattner's campaign obviously pushed back to that, saying that a record number of voters came out in the primary to support him, and he's just trying to ensure that his replacement process is open, which sort of seems to be the shared goal. But I think since the party has called on him to drop out, and rather than make a public announcement, I think his campaign is reaching out to them to understand further steps. There seems to be some frustration there, and I'm not sure about the legality of this, but they seem to claim that they cannot announce the replacement process until he drops out, which of course puts a ticking clock on all of this, because they only have a couple weeks, assuming he is going to drop out, to pick his replacement. So I think the time limit is also introducing some tension into this dynamic.
Yeah, this is a big deal. And I know it's really, to say the least, very disappointing to many of Plattner's supporters and Maine Democrats, but also nationwide, because this is a very high stakes seat. And a lot of Democrats were hoping that this would be a seat in play to flip from Republican Susan Collins. Maine Democrats need to get somebody to replace him if he does drop out. Have you heard about any names at all? What's floating around?
So there are a few names being considered based on what the candidates have told me. The Maine Democratic Party has not confirmed who they're going to pick or how, and that how will also be very important in ensuring that this remains a process where voters can have their say. However, there's one candidate former Senate President Troy Jackson, who also ran in the main Democratic gubernatorial primary, who has filed paperwork with the FEC to form an exploratory committee to figure out whether he can run. So basically, Troy is the only person who has taken that concrete step of saying his hat is in the ring if the Democratic Party so chooses. And he seems to be the most politically aligned with Plattner, has campaigned on that sort of grassroots workers' rights angle since he entered the campaign. He's also been fighting for similar issues for about 20 years in Maine. So he had a lot of support, you know, and he's from Aroostook County, which Susan Collins is also from. So he seems to share a lot of the commonalities with Plattner in terms of, you know, speaking to a certain voter base. The Democratic Party establishment and Troy Jackson have not always seen eye to eye. There's been several clashes with him and our current governor, Janet Mills. So we'll see where Troy Jackson's candidacy stands. But political scientists told me that he seems to be the closest match to Plattner, if that is what the party is looking for. Another name being thrown around a lot is Dr. Nirav Shah. He was Maine's former head of the CDC. He became briefly the second in command of the U.S. CDC and came back to Maine to run for governor and was the front runner for much of the race before he lost in the final round of the ranked choice runoffs. He has been also answering a lot of phone calls from people exploring whether he can be Plattner's replacement. Shah said he is not certain yet whether he's throwing his hat into the ring, but he is certainly open to the idea. But he said he would want to make sure that the process is open so that people can weigh in before he says yes or no. I think Shenna Bellows, our Secretary of State, also another Democratic gubernatorial candidate, has thrown her hat into the ring as well, as have a couple people who ran in some other races, such as Jordan Wood, who was initially a Senate candidate and then switched to run to replace Jared Golden, and a couple others in those races. So there are a bunch of names being thrown around right now. We don't know how this is going to unfold, so we don't know who the front runner is.
And can you remind us what happened to Janet Mills?
Yeah, so Janet Mills stayed on the ballot. She got about, I might not be right, but she got about 18% of the vote in the primary. So obviously Plattner won by a landslide, but people did vote for her, although she had suspended her campaign. So she was not campaigning anymore. She was not advocating for people to vote for her in a traditional sense, but she did remind voters that her name is still on the ballot and people did vote for her. We haven't heard from her. I've asked her campaign a few times since Tuesday or Monday evening whether they have any plans to make a statement, and she has stayed quiet this whole time. The Maine Democratic Party has also not answered whether they would be looking to Mills to be Plattner's replacement. But we have heard from voters that picking someone new might be better than relying on Mills again.
Can you walk us through some of the legal deadlines and explain what happens if Plattner withdraws before, you mentioned, July 13th versus what happens if he chooses to stay in the race, which is highly unlikely?
Yes. Basically, according to Maine law, the deadline for a candidate to withdraw is July 13th, which is just a few days away. And if he does not withdraw, his name will appear on the ballot. According to Maine law, a political action committee may make the replacement nomination no later than 5 p.m. of the fourth Monday in July, which is a couple weeks from now. So if Plattner withdraws, the Maine Democratic Party will be the legal entity responsible for picking his replacement. And there have been no previous instances, according to our Secretary of State, where Maine candidates have won a primary and then withdrawn before the general election. I think there were some instances in the mid to late 19th century and early 20th century when a congressional or senatorial seat needed to be filled after someone resigned their position, but that was during an active term. And there has just been no precedent for in Maine law for how to handle this situation.
That was Isha Pendarkar from the Maine Morning Star.
Will changing campaign finance rules meaningfully change the role of money in politics? Many people hope so. The U.S. Supreme Court last week has once again redrawn the rules governing money in politics, expanding how political parties can coordinate spending with candidates. To help unpack what the decision means for the 2026 midterm elections, I'm joined by Brendan Glavin, Director of Insights at the political money watchdog Open Secrets. So last week, the Supreme Court changed the rules on how certain kinds of campaign finance spending works. Why don't you walk me through that?
Sure. So you know, we have, as a baseline, it's that kind of explains how this all comes together. And we have contribution limits. Most people are familiar with this. To if you want to give money to a candidate, there's a contribution limit for a federal candidate for Congress or president. It's $3,500 per election this year. It's indexed, and they change it every 2 years. This year, it's $3,500. The primary and a general count each separately. So functionally, an individual can give $7,000 to a candidate, and that's it. Now, because we have these limits, they instituted rules on how much the party can spend in coordination with a candidate, because to avoid people giving money to the party to get around these contribution limits. And that's why they had these rules. Now, the Supreme Court has ruled that those limits are unconstitutional, that the party should be allowed to spend as much money they want in coordination with the candidates. So coordination is the key word. The parties have always spent lots of money supporting their candidates, but they're only allowed to do it in coordination, meaning like getting together with the candidate and deciding on strategy and deciding who's going to spend where and how much and that sort of thing. That's what we mean by coordination. So that's the sort of thing that was limited in what they were allowed to do.
Right. So, for example, before, I assume there was just a lot of super PACs spending going on where they're not technically allowed to coordinate with the candidate. Is that what's changed?
No. So the super PACs are going to exist separately from this ruling. This is strictly talking about the party committees themselves. Like, you know, people are familiar with like the DNC and the RNC, Republican National Committee, Democratic National Committee. Then there's also the committees, similar committees for the congressional, on the congressional side. So those are the those specific committees, like the party money that it was restricted and how much they could coordinate with the candidates. Then the super PACs exist separately. Of course, they're not allowed to do any coordination at all. Generally speaking, right, they can't coordinate with candidates. So they operate independently, whereas the party committees were allowed to do some coordination. It was just how much they could spend was limited.
How much has it been increased by, or is that not something that's...
So they basically said no more limits on the coordination, on the spending caps, essentially, is what they were.
And so how do you see that affecting elections going forwards?
So what that is going to create is a situation where it's going to allow the party to go out and, one, they're going to go out and be able to spend money without having to have this, firewall where they're... would do independent spending and say, we're going to spend money supporting our candidate, but they couldn't coordinate with the candidate. So now they can get together. It's going to help them on the spending side. It's going to help them be more targeted. And the big thing that a lot of people talk about around this is, so because they can do it directly, then you can expect to see a bit of a fundraising boom for the parties, in that people... if people know they can give money to the party and then the party is allowed to go and coordinate directly with the candidate and spend that money directly on the candidate, then they might be more likely to give to the party. You're probably going to see a lot more joint fundraising committees set up. I mean, they're pretty common already, but I think you'll see even more of them where candidates get together with the party, set up these joint fundraisers, and then people can... essentially, someone who could only give $7,000 before, now they may be more willing to give maybe $50,000 or $100,000 because they know that the portion of that that goes to the party will then essentially go right back and be spent on the candidate that they want to be supported.
Taking a step back, why were these laws instituted in the first place? What were the lawmakers trying to prevent with these limits?
essentially, right, with limits, with contribution limits to candidates and these spending limits with the parties, you're trying to prevent corruption where one person giving a lot of money directly to a candidate and getting essentially, you know, you have the actual corruption or even the appearance of corruption. What this change does is it's an end run around the limits to the candidates. It makes it easier for someone who wants to give money to a candidate to funnel that money to the candidate without having to abide by the limits. So that's why these spending caps for the parties were put in the first place, in order to prevent that overrunning the contribution limits to the candidates.
Looking at the sort of wider picture, with, of course, Citizens United, and now this, do you see this as a trend towards kind of heading in the direction of abolishing limits completely for everyone?
I don't know if I'd go that far at this point, but it's certainly one, the trend is this deregulatory trend where, Citizens United and its follow-on case, Speech Now, are the big ones that everybody hears about, because that's what gave us the situation where we have these super PACs, and where, in the last presidential election, you had Elon Musk, you know, creating his own super PAC and, you know, putting millions and millions of dollars into it. And over time, we've had additional cases coming out of the courts where there used to be a limit on the maximum amount that an individual could give to candidates or PACs or parties. There was basically what they called an aggregate limit that one individual could give across different groups that had limits on them. That was struck down. Now we have, you know, this being struck down. So certainly I see that, you know, the next step maybe, and Justice Kavanaugh even alluded to it during the case that, you know, they may come back as the next step and try to get rid of the limits to the parties themselves. So even though the parties have very high limits, but there are limits on how much an individual can give to a party. But that may be the next thing on the block that they try to take down. And then over time, then you may see it could be they're going after the limits to the candidates. Although at a certain point, when you remove limits on everything else and only thing left is the limits of the candidates, those limits don't mean a whole lot because people can have so many other avenues to pour as much money as they want.
Right. If you can give unlimited amounts to parties and parties can give unlimited amounts to the candidate of choice, then can you not essentially give unlimited amounts to the candidate of choice already?
Essentially, I mean, technically the parties aren't giving the money to the candidate, but when you're spending it in coordination with the candidate, then you're right, that difference kind of evaporates, right? They're not actually writing the check and giving the money to the candidate, but if they all sit in a room together and decide how to spend the money, it's basically the same thing.
Right. How concerned should we be about this growing influence of money in politics?
I think it's a great concern because it involves different aspects to it. One is it involves a lot of, right, mega wealthy, mega donors who end up having an outsized influence on our system. Most of the money that's flowing into the system is coming from these uber wealthy donors. One of the other things that comes along with this system that is growing is this issue of what we call dark money, and that there's a lot of it within super PACs where super PACs have to disclose who their donors are, but in a lot of instances the donors themselves, it may be C4s are a very popular vehicle for this, 501c4s, which are nonprofit organizations. C4s don't have to disclose their donors. So the super PAC may disclose who their donor is, but if the donor is an organization that hides its donors, then you really don't know where the money is coming from. And so part of this deregulation and this system that we have now is this is a real problem with that, where there's a lot of money being spent. We don't know where the money's coming from. When I say we, I mean, you know, people like myself who are researchers and who look at this sort of thing, but also just voters, citizens don't know who's funding the ads they're seeing, who's creating this content that's trying to influence them. And so it's hard to go in and make an informed decision as a voter when you're getting all this information and you don't know, well, who's creating that? What's their motivation? What's their potential? What do they stand to gain from it? Do they have a financial interest in trying to convince me to vote one way or the other? And when all that information is hidden away from the public, then, you know, we really lose out.
Do you know if this is a partisan issue? I know some analysis I read seemed to indicate that in the short term, this would benefit Republicans because they currently have a larger war chest. But in the long term, do you think Democrats will ultimately end up supporting these changes as well, since they will also be able to donate or spend more?
Yeah, I think a lot of times, when you get these changes, and sometimes like one side is, they see the short term benefit, and certainly for the on the Republican side, yes, they have going into this election, they have a big war chest, and especially at the party level. And that will help them to a certain extent. But these things change cycle to cycle. And what's good for one side today may be bad for them in 4 years and good for the other side. So I think these things move around a lot. And generally, a lot of times, their positions they have on them change from cycle to cycle, depending on whether or not they feel it's going to be good for them in the moment.
All right. Well, Brendan Glavin, thank you so much for talking to me.
All right. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Brendan Glavin, Director of Insights at the political data and analytics nonprofit Open Secrets, which tracks money in American politics.
We don't want communists in our country.
President Donald Trump used his 4th of July speech to revive one of the oldest themes in American politics. Speaking from the National Mall, Trump repeatedly warned about what he called the threat of communism in the United States.
Our warriors did not fight communism on battlefields across the world, only to have that menace rear its ugly head right back here in America.
At Mount Rushmore the previous evening, Trump repeated the theme.
The Communist Party is made up of illegal immigrants, criminals, and everybody that doesn't want to work.
There are no self-identified communists serving in Congress or holding major elected office in the United States. But Trump's comments come as a number of Democratic Socialist candidates have scored upset victories in Democratic primaries this year, like in New York City, Washington, D.C., and Colorado. Republicans are more and more portraying those wins as evidence that the Democratic Party is moving too sharply to the left, stoking old-timey Red Scare fears.
The question is, have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
Sunday, House Speaker Mike Johnson echoed Trump's message.
We were saying it was common sense versus crazy. Now it's common sense versus communism.
The attacks also expose a debate inside the Democratic Party over how leftward its candidates should go. Progressives argue their recent victories reflect voters' frustration with the political status quo. But public opinion might be more nuanced. Recent polling shows roughly one-third of Americans now view socialism favorably. That's the highest level in years, suggesting the label no longer carries the same political stigma for many younger generations than it did back in McCarthy's days. With the midterm campaign beginning to take shape, Republicans are betting that warnings about socialism and communism are going to resonate with swing voters. Joining us now to discuss is Michael Tomasky, writer for The New Republic and author of the recent article. And I love the headline, Donald Trump has a new and stupid and likely ineffective favorite word. Thanks for chatting with me, Michael.
Thank you so much for having me. Pleasure.
And that favorite word is communism. This is what we're talking about. Okay. So President Donald Trump has been now kind of debuting a strategy, and he's making communism
one of his central attack lines against Democrats, you know, and calling them a major threat to the country. And this is like bringing up all this history of Red Scare tactics from the Cold War era. And I don't know, it seems kind of hokey, in my opinion. What do you say?
It does seem kind of hokey. I mean, first of all, we know, you know, he's a, as we all are, he's a person of his time and place and environment. So, you know, he grew up in, the, you know, Archie Bunker's Queens, more or less, although before that, in the 40s and 50s when he was a kid. And, yeah, so back then, calling somebody a commie packed quite a wallop, I guess. And those were serious times. You know, there were Joe McCarthy and the Red Scare, and you know, people were falsely accused of being members of the Communist Party, or in some cases accurately accused, but their lives, livelihoods, and careers were unjustly finished. I think it resonates with him in his brain for those sort of historical reasons. Will it resonate with the American electorate of the year 2026? I'm less certain about that. You know, Fox and Newsmax and all these other right-wing propaganda outlets will push it out there. And they'll try to make it resonate, and it'll get some legs within the MAGA community, and maybe on the fringes of the MAGA community. But really, I think, you know, a lot of the country doesn't even have a working memory of what communism was anymore. And you know, the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. Those are nearly 40 years ago. So you'd have to be older than 45 to have any working memory of those things. And more than half the country is under 45.
So I'm over 45, and some of us are old enough to remember seeing the breadlines on TV,
yeah,
in the USSR way back in the 20th century, and people begging for Levi's jeans and Michael Jackson tapes. And, you know, my grandmother was from Poland and was communist at that time. And I do remember as a kid spending hours putting together packages that she would make for our Polish relatives that had all kinds of, you know, consumer goods that they couldn't get in Poland at that time. But yeah, like you just said, that for some of us who are old enough to remember, it was like a low standard of living, right?
Yeah.
For people in the Soviet Union. But for people who don't recall that era, it just doesn't carry that same political power that it once did among younger voters. But for some of these older Americans, you think it may not carry the same kind of punch that it did?
I think if you're ideologically inclined to agree with Donald Trump, then sure. But I think even most older Americans who do remember those bread lines and those empty store shelves, your average person doesn't think the Democrats are communistic. I don't think it does. But, you know, we're going to hear a lot of it between now and November. I don't have any doubt about that.
But we are seeing these political upsets by the Democratic Socialists in New York and in Colorado, D.C. What is being put forward by the DSA and the Democratic Socialists is one thing. Trump and the Republicans are intentionally blurring these lines, right, between kind of this USSR Stalin-esque communism, and they're blurring that between socialism and then democratic socialism. Could you explain the differences? Our KPFA audience probably knows really well.
Yeah, I would imagine, yeah.
But
I would, yeah.
Why do those distinctions matter in this political strategy?
You know, those distinctions don't really matter that much in the current American context. And I think those distinctions would get lost on a lot of people. I mean, yeah, technically a communist is someone who believes in a dictatorship of the proletariat. A democratic socialist is somebody who believes in small d democracy. So would follow the results of an election, but would impose socialism, by which historically is meant state ownership of the means of production, once they won the election. And indeed, that's what socialist governments did in Europe in the 20th century, for example. When the British Labour Party won an election, Harold Wilson say, they'd come in and they'd pass the coal mines and the steel mills to the government to run. Technically that's what a democratic socialist is. Then the least, you know, the softest version is social democrat. And that's really not that distinguishable from a liberal capital D New Deal Democrat in the American context. And it's interesting to me because actually Sanders and AOC and Mamdani and literally all these people, they're really social democrats. They use the phrase democratic socialist for a set of sort of complicated historical reasons that we don't have the time to burrow into here. What they're calling for, more important than the label, is the kind of things they're calling for. The kind of things they're calling for are certainly state interventionists, certainly higher taxes, certainly more public investment, but they're not outlandish in an American context. I mean, they want universal health care. Harry Truman tried to pass universal health care. Is Harry Truman a communist? I don't think so. In fact, he was pretty strong anti-communist.
So what do we do about this strategy? Democrats should not simply dismiss this, but they should respond forcefully. What do you think Democrats should do to answer these accusations that they are like big C communists heading into the midterm elections?
On the one hand, there's an argument to be made that they should just laugh that off. I would also like to see them point out to people that the actual extremist party in this country is the Republican Party, not the Democratic Party. As I write in there, the Democrats could elect 24 more socialists and they still wouldn't have moved as far to the left as the Republican Party has moved to the right in the Trump age and in other ways in this century. And I could document thing after thing after thing to support that case. You know, Ronald Reagan signed a voting rights bill. George W. Bush increased the minimum wage. Both of those things are absolutely off the table now as far as Republicans are concerned. There's a whole bunch of policy things like that. In addition to the fact, of course, that the sitting president invited an avowed white supremacist to dine with him at his home. Nick Fuentes invited down to Mar-a-Lago. And the sitting president has allied the United States, broadly speaking, against the world's democracies and with the world's neo-fascist, fake democracies. So, you know, the Republican Party is far, far to the right. And there's the whole Christian nationalist wing of the Republican Party, which wants the United States to be a Christian theocracy. They're far more extreme than Democrats are. You know, Trump is an ignoramus about these historical questions. He doesn't, he obviously, in some sense, he knows what communism was. He lived through that age. But, he's just trying to make the election a referendum on something but himself. He's trying to make the election a referendum on the alleged extremism of the Democrats. And I don't think at bottom, at the end of the day, unless economic circumstances improve markedly between now and November, I don't think overall that it's in the cards for that to work. I think Trump is so omnipresent in our lives, you know, 4 press conferences a day and all this stuff. He makes it about himself. So it's going to be about him, you know, the prices, the inflation, the condition of the economy, people's feelings about their lives. It's going to be about him. And if those things aren't positive, I don't think painting, picture of Lenin, Marx and Lenin on the Democratic National Committee headquarters is going to make any difference.
Well, we'll all be watching Fidel on streaming. Well, thanks for chatting with me today, Michael.
Thank you, Teresa.
And now for our moment in media literacy with Project Censored.
Hello, this is Mickey Huff with Eleanor Goldfield from the Project Censored Show, and this is your critical media literacy moment for The Stakes. Eleanor Goldfield, good to be with you again for our presentation for the listeners of The Stakes.
Absolutely, Mickey, and thanks everybody for tuning in to this week.
You know, in the last couple days or so, we've learned a lot about a Senator Mitch McConnell again, and the fact that he may actually be in the process of dying. He may be brain dead. There may be lots of things that are going on around that. But Eleanor, political satirist Lee Camp, wrote an interesting piece looking at this, criticizing the Senate as basically an unrepresentative body for we the people. Anyway, so I figured we could riff on that for a few minutes, but the critical media literacy lens here that we want to maybe call attention to for our listeners is people should be aware of different kinds of techniques to distract, to kind of paraphrase our good friend, the late, great George Carlin. We should be mindful of euphemisms and euphemistic language to kind of conceal things. We should also, as Carlin once quipped, not accept double standards. One standard is good enough. We should just have the one standard to apply. And McConnell, of course, his career has been a master of double standards. And we think that it's really important as a critical media literacy exercise that people think critically, ask questions, and really think about how material is being presented. And in this case, of course, there is the fixation on the senator himself. But Eleanor, what are some other things that maybe we're missing here in the current saga?
Yeah, absolutely, Mickey. I mean, I think it's funny that Republicans oftentimes talk about how there's all these dead people on voter rolls, and that's a problem when statistically it's not. And yet you can have a dead person in Congress, and that's apparently not a problem. And of course, like listeners might be familiar with the study that came out. Now it's like 12 years ago, yeah. That I kind of said the things that we all kind of felt, that basically the U.S. is an oligarchy. And it proved, basically looking through, you know, decades of rulings inside Congress, that Congress is not moved by public opinion, which, if you think about it, is kind of their job.
Particularly the Senate.
Right. It showed that, you know, our representative bodies go by what corporations, what these donors want, and not what we the people want. And this is, you know, the kind of the point that Lee Camp was making, and you guys, folks can check out his Substack, but basically that not only does it not change our lived experiences, which should say something if a representative of your government all of a sudden is dead, or you're not sure whether they're dead, that should have some effect on daily life, but also that we don't have a right to know, you know, that we the people are not authorized to know whether one of our representatives is alive or dead. I mean, it's just basic, right? This is basic information. And of course, for folks not aware, like why they would want to hide it, because if someone dies in a situation like this, the governor of that state gets to choose a replacement, and the GOP does not want that. And so this is why they're basically trying to hide whether he's alive or dead, and then being really cagey about it. And of course, the critical media literacy angle here is like, we should be asking these questions, and we should also then push for, you know, the deeper question, the layered question that is beyond this is, why doesn't this matter? And then what does this say about the role of Congress in a quote-unquote country of we the people when it doesn't change our lived experience with whether we know or don't know whether this person is alive or dead? He's Schrodinger's Congress member.
Yeah, and Weekend at Bernie's Redux. New Jersey Republican Representative Tom Keen Jr. missed 100 votes in Congress, had been away from Congress for months and months. And again, not making light of this, claimed that he's dealing with issues of depression, but basically went into hiding. And there's no accountability. There was no real communication about this. And in the case of McConnell, they're waiting for a deadline, right? No puns intended, to, you know, see whether or not there could be a special election. Somebody else gets in. So this is also tactical in some ways, which actually is, yeah, I'm kind of morbid, but I mean, and also the media infatuation around some of the sensationalism of these kind of topics really doesn't help people understand the significant overarching analysis that you just shared, Eleanor, that these bodies in the Congress haven't been representative of the views of the public for a very, very long time. And this is something that the corporate press should be spending more time talking about as we enter the midterm election season. But unfortunately, they're not, and they're going to continue to cover these kinds of sensational issues, and they're going to continue to misdirect people away from actually seizing their own power and trying to at least use what levers we have through the primary systems, as troublesome and problematic as they are, with big money and lobby money and everything else. But again, I see these things as larger distractions, and they're keeping us from actually focusing on the things that are inherently been wrong with the system for a really long time. And I think it really is another hurdle as to the way in which people can address it to try to change it. So Eleanor, any last thoughts today?
Yeah, I just want to point out that I think, again, like with regards to your comment about the depression, I think journalists who cover that story should then point out how many people are allowed to take sick days for depression. Right. How many people are allowed access to the same kind of health care that members of Congress have? And so these are the kind of comparisons that need to be highlighted when we talk about these stories that our so-called representatives are engaged in. So again, thanks everybody for tuning in to this week's episode of Project Censored on The Stakes, and we'll see you next time.
See ya. And we want to thank everybody for tuning in to The Stakes.
Those were the voices of Mickey Huff and Eleanor Goldfield from Project Censored.
That's it for the show. The Stakes airs Thursdays at 10 a.m. Check for information about topics and guests online at kpfa.org. For comments and ideas, connect with us at news@kpfa.org. A big thanks to the team Lauren Schmidt and Jose Gonzalez with Kirsten Thomas at the controls. I'm Scott Baba with Teresa Wears Bianska.